Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. In this episode, we'll be discussing the resurgence of medical shows like The Pitt, reviews of The Amateur and The King of Kings, what is the deal with revenge everywhere, and so much more. So let's get on with the show. My name's Aaron Peterson. Joining me today, my fellow host, Troy Heinrichs.
What's up, everybody? I'm back. Taking the Amanda spot.
John Davenport.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, and Amanda Sink will not be here. Are you guys just like alternating weeks now? Is that what's going on?
Yeah. She told me to say, hell no, hell no. That's how she felt about this topic.
I see what you did. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Remember, you can always find more information at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Find us on Facebook, X, Threads, wherever you find your podcast, and you can rate and subscribe on your preferred podcast app. And be sure to check out our true crime podcast, Inspired by a True Story, which is going to have a new episode very soon on Facebook, meaning the social network. The excitement is
the social network
palpable.
Like it's like the only one, like the master.
The movie.
Well, it's the name of the movie.
Oh, it's the movie.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is good. I like that movie.
Yeah, a lot of people do like that movie until you watch it and then listen to Aaron talk about it. And then you're like, you're right, Aaron, you're right. This movie sucks.
I didn't say the movie sucks. Like once you actually know some of the true facts behind it, you're like, well, God, that takes
Social
away
media the media sucks.
Yeah. Which is about the third or fourth time he's done that to me on that show. Cause like there was another show that another movie that I sat there and I was like, God, that was really great.
Texas
I really
Killing enjoyed it. He was like, it's a great movie. I'm like, it's a fucking terrible movie.
I fucking enjoyed it. And you sat there and like tore the shreds and then Amanda tore the shreds. And I'm like, I guess it is a bad movie.
I mean, that's on you. If you change your opinion based on what other people say, my opinion stands.
I didn't see the things that everyone hated about it until you started pointing it out. I'm like, I guess you're right.
You get wiser as you get older. It's fine. You've just been educated. It's all good.
Let's discuss. There we go. We have a good talking point to start off. So do other people's opinions influence your opinions?
If I respect them, yeah, obviously.
Because I have a friend, good friend of the show, Scott Clark, right? Long-time listeners know who he is, short-timers probably don't. But Scott has a thing where if he goes to see a movie and the people he's with don't enjoy it, he has a hard time enjoying it. I don't have this problem. I can go and I just tune whatever nonsense that is out and just enjoy or don't enjoy whatever I'm watching. Do you guys have that where that influences you?
Like there's been plenty of times where I've been able to go to something and I've had a great time watching it, but like I feel empathy for the fact that somebody feels like they wasted their time or somebody just couldn't get it or somebody didn't understand what was happening or there was a guy crinkling some wrapper behind us and that really took them out of the movie the entire time.
That's a different thing. I'm talking just the opinion and the vibe of whoever I sound like a mandarin. Just the opinion or the vibe of whoever you're with or talking to about a movie that distorts your opinion. I know Troy's answer. I just know Troy. I just know his answer. But
well, I mean, if they have valid points, then I will listen to it. That's all of what we do here, right?
I think it's more than opinion. It's a little bit more done a lot. I mean, what is it, 3 years of TV that I've watched? I mean, we have some like credibility behind the opinion also.
Sure, you got a little weight. But it's your opinion. So like, it isn't that I discount anyone else's take on it if they didn't like something or they love something. I'm happy when people love things that I didn't like, and I'm like, it kind of makes me want to rewatch it and see if I'm going to see what they saw. But an opinion is my opinion. I mean, I watched it. Unless I happen to walk into it with a bad mood, which I don't ever really do, then I would say that my opinion would probably stand.
No, I think Aaron needs to clarify his statement, because if someone says that they like something and it might give them the idea to rewatch it again, as long as that person wasn't Troy,
right?
Because he still has never finished Leftovers.
I didn't like The Leftovers. I gave that show like 3 or 4 shots just because you kept praising it. 3 or 4 times, I'm like, when is this thing good? Why do I want to watch something that makes me sad for an hour at a time? Like, you just want to sit there and be sad for an hour at a clip? That's so much sadness. I get tired. Oh, you know, it's got one of the best endings ever. How did you get there? It's so fucking sad. Jesus. Sorry.
You got to suffer to get to the hope.
Yeah. Well, let's take this example of The Texas Killing Field, which is a movie that I thoroughly enjoyed when
I think you needed a better example.
I'm just using that as my example because it's the most recent time that this has happened. But, you know, we were having a very educated, smart conversation about it. And as we were having this very educated, smart conversation about a movie that I thoroughly enjoyed,
I think you guys started very smart as, you know, hedging that bet a little bit, but you go ahead.
Yeah. I'm being kind. Okay. It's better than calling you an idiot. You guys did not like it. I did. But when you started pointing out the reasons that you didn't like it, now I started going, oh yeah, you're right. That's kind of stupid. Oh, that's kind of stupid too. Ugh. All right. Maybe that is kind of stupid. I'm okay with that because you're seeing something that I didn't see, and that's okay. That's the whole purpose we have these conversations. And if I go to a movie and I really enjoy it and I talk to somebody and they're like, oh, it was garbage. Well, what do you mean it was garbage? Well, because of this and that. I'm like, well, you need to get over yourself. I'm okay with saying that too, depending on what it is.
Troy, where do you stand? I feel like I know.
I don't know, Aaron. Where do I stand?
I think Troy is a very measured opinionator. So if he has an opinion, I just think it takes, you have to move a mountain for him to change that.
Oh, okay. I'm very stuck in my ways is what you're saying.
I don't see it that way. I know some people probably say it like that, but I don't think it's a stubborn thing. If you watch something and you have an opinion, it's your opinion. So it's, no, I don't see it that way. But you are stubborn. I'm not taking that away from you. So that's still there.
It's very true. You know, over the years, I think I've gravitated towards a place of, I just want to talk about the movie afterwards. I don't care if you liked it. I don't care if you disliked it. I just want to talk about it. Like, what did you take away from this experience? If it was absolutely nothing, then I think I'd get a little bit more frustrated with that experience of having watched it. Mm-hmm. But as long as you're willing to have a conversation and say like, no, man, like watching Sand for 2.5 hours was awful. You know, great. I get your point, you know, but I like going to the beach. The beach is good. I sit there for 2.5 hours. So what was different? What specifically about the Sand didn't you like?
Timothée Chalamet is in front of you the whole time?
Yeah.
That'll do it.
That dialogue, I think, is why we go see art in the first place, whether it's at the art museum or the movie or the TV show or read a book, right? You want to have conversation about
it. I see more things that I wouldn't have seen because, you know, you guys and other people are like, talk about them. I would have never watched Flow, number one, just recent examples. I would have never watched Cattle Lake.
Because it was animated and cats.
and no speaking. Yeah, I don't like cats.
And no speaking. If there was a twin, it would have been really bad.
I just saw something with twins and I'm like, oh my God, why is this always got to be the thing?
Was it Social Network?
Yes. Yeah, it was.
I wouldn't have watched Cattle Lake if John hadn't mentioned about Cattle Lake. Cattle Lake is so good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was great. That's what I'm saying. Like, so these conversations can help, but it doesn't change my opinion. Like, if I watch it just because you praise it, if I don't like it, I'm just not going to like it. Leftovers, I legitimately tried to enjoy because so many people I know love that show, including Troy, specifically Troy, but also, you know, other people, Scott and Wayne, other people that I've known have loved that show. And I'm just like, it's not for me. And some things sometimes are not for you. I don't like things that are just dire. That's not fun to me. I need something. Like Succession. I don't enjoy that show because it's just about rich assholes. I don't want to watch it. I've tried it. I'm like, I don't like anybody here. I need somebody I like, even if they're a bad person. I need an Alan Rickman. You know, if I'm going to have all bad people, I need one person I'm like, I could get behind them because I would have been fine if Hans Gruber won. Sorry. You know,
at least he was charming as hell.
Exactly.
I think you'd like Industry on HBO.
I wouldn't mind trying that one as long as there's humor. You know, and it's not just rich a-holes.
No.
I don't. Succession to me, I just, let's watch people that are rich get richer and screw people over to get more money. That's just not something that I ever really care about. It's not for me.
I'll probably get my TV card revoked because, like, I didn't watch Succession or Billions because I thought they were kind of the same show to me because they were, like, on at the same time. Just two different networks. So I haven't watched either one of those.
I think we're all okay about that.
Yeah. That one. Both of those are a hard pass. I mean, Succession's got all sorts of great awards and acting accolades and all that jazz, and people were able to break out into the world of other acting because of it. Yeah. Good for them.
Kieran Culkin's blown up.
Yeah, I don't need to watch it.
It's like Righteous Gemstones. I think Righteous Gemstones is probably a great show. I think you have to be immersed into that TV evangelism culture or have been around at those times to understand like the inside jokes to really get the show. Like my friend who's like 10 years older than me, who like lived through that era, like loves the show. I'm like, I'm watching it and I'm like, it's good, but it's not like knocking my socks off. I'm probably missing something.
I want to watch it, but my grandfather was a pastor and I just feel like it's going to be too mocking.
Of your family.
Yeah, I'll feel like I'm insulting him or something by watching it. So I don't want to do that. But I have seen, and I'm, you know, I don't love Danny McBride, but you've got Walton Goggins on there, apparently water skiing naked as a 70 something year old man. Like that, okay, you're winning me over with that. That's a great sales pitch. I don't know. There's a lot of great stuff out there that other people have recommended. White Lotus is something I still haven't watched, but my dad and my mom, who don't agree on anything, especially politically, they both suggested I watch that show. So that's one I just feel like I have to, just on principle, to find out like how these two can watch something and agree on it.
My wife is saying the same thing. Like, why haven't you watched this yet? Maybe, Aaron, we have to do it and do a podcast. I don't know.
I don't think we need another one. No.
This is why the people in our life, we'll call it people in our lives that make us watch stuff.
That's what we should, a spinoff called They Made Me Watch It.
They made me watch this. Oh my God, this is almost a brilliant show. We made you watch this. That
I like it.
Like all we do is talk, like watch this one episode of a show and that's it. And then we sit down and talk about it for 45 minutes.
We could do that on the regular episode. Just make it like a shorter bit. Okay, we watched this one. What did we think? This is terrible. This is great. I'm going to continue watch. Something like that. That would be fun. We should add that. That's a good idea.
And like middle, like season 2, episode 5. We just pick something at random. On.
Yeah. Yeah.
See if you can figure out what's going on. Jack Bowers in the middle of the day. What's happening?
We can call the bit The Forcening.
No. No.
No?
They made me watch it was way better. Come on.
All right.
The Forcening, that just everything about that, I feel like is a little too me too. All right. So revenge. Let's talk about revenge. Are we going to ever take a look at this like as a dangerous concept? That's something I just kind of, you know, I saw The Amateur, and I'll talk about it a little bit later, but John Wick, we're okay with him totally murdering hundreds of people just because of a dog, and any other revenge tale. If someone was wronged in any way, we're okay with them randomly killing people and walking away from it. So I guess, do you ever think, and I think Promising Young Woman probably came close to making this close to a reality in terms of how it would really feel. But do you feel like we never really take this concept and do something genuine with it? It's always just hyper stylized. You know what I mean? Rather than this is like a really bad idea.
Revenge is a good thing.
Yeah, that's how it's always painted, right? Revenge is always a good thing. It's a thrill.
I'm going to get you, sucker.
Revenge is often served up as justice, but edgier. So it's like the more emotionally satisfying sibling of justice.
I like that.
Yeah, which is why one of the greatest quotes about revenge actually came from James Spader on The Blacklist when Red's character says,
of course he
revenge
did.
Isn't a passion. It's a disease that eats at your mind and poisons your soul.
I mean, that's what it probably is.
All right. Yeah. Right?
But you never see that in movies. It's just people are kicking ass and taking names, or, hey, we're doing this thing. Boy, I feel bad about it, but I have to kill these 18 people. Just to make up for the life I
John
lost.
John Wick was like, always more than 18. John Wick was way, way more than 18.
I've been going for 4 movies to kill people about my dog, and now I may be dead?
Not anymore.
Well, the thing that I like about in some movies, especially when it comes to revenge, is that the people are always leaning on the concept of whenever you go out for revenge, dig 2 graves. And that's always something that's really important, because I feel like that somebody who's going out for revenge always forgets the basis of like why we are here or what's important about life, and they basically serve themselves up in every single way to have something befall on them times 3.
Yeah, or they spend their whole life just going after it, and then when it's finally resolved, they're like, "Where is everybody? Why nobody here? Where'd all my friends go?" Like,
yeah. It never really deals with the cost of revenge, because revenge has a cost to it in its own, where you actively alienate people, you alienate those people who are closest to you, you inevitably hurt every single thing that you can possibly hurt, and then it leaves a mark on your soul in a way that you will never actually be fulfilled or can be fulfilled again.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and look at, I mean, there are so few films that have done it, but Kill Bill actually paints the picture right? When she kills Vivica A. Fox and her daughter's there, she's like, hey, if you ever feel wrong about it or raw about it, I'll understand. Like, if you have to come back and get revenge on me. So, I mean, at least they painted the picture like you realize that you're leaving someone behind that's going to have the same pain that you do, but you're justifying it in your head and you understand if they come back and try to get revenge on you. But not too often do they do that in movies or TV for that matter.
Yeah, no, it's always like that conversation of, hey, if you want to have a conversation later in life, I'm down to have that conversation. And it's always kind of portrayed like that.
Well, and when you say not on TV, do you want the audience to feel it or do you want the character to feel it? Because like I'm thinking like Dolores, right, in Westworld, right, that second season when she's like on the revenge quest and then ends up losing Teddy, right, at some point, you know, with the way Teddy feels about everything that's going down. Like we as the audience feel the loss of what happens with revenge, but Dolores, the character, did not. So like, are you hoping for the character to actually feel it as well?
Yeah, I want the character to feel regret, remorse, restraint, really have to wrestle with it. I think that's important. Too often it's just, you know, it just comes too easily to the characters that are, you know, it's just Jason Statham there or John Wick or whoever the action hero is, ballerina, whatever. They just show up, get revenge. They're killing tons of people. They really don't know how guilty or innocent they are. They're just in their way, you know? And I don't think that's, I love those movies. I'm somebody who loves those movies. I go to see them all the time, but I do wish there's a little bit more humanity in it. That's all I'm saying.
You know, as much as I'm tired of this whole topic being in conversations these days, I think I'm a little Game of Thrones out, but Game of Thrones, I feel like did revenge pretty well.
That's fair. Yeah, that's a good point.
It really did show the ebb and flow of how revenge goes. It's almost like watching this fish eat another fish, eat another fish, and eat another fish, and eat another fish. And you constantly have that going on throughout the series where it takes a dragon to finally put an end to all of it.
It sounds like Lord of the Rings, too. Gollum eats another fish, eats another fish, dies by fire.
See, yeah. As soon as I said it, I was going to welcome like something like that in here.
Juicy sweet!
Hey, you know what's exciting? Novocaine. Not the actual Novocaine. It usually means you're getting, you know, you're at the dentist. But the movie Novocaine, you can bring it home right now. You can bring home Novocaine right now. Buy it on digital. And what it's about is when the girl of his dreams is taken hostage, Nathan Kane's inability to feel pain will be his greatest strength in the fight to get her back. So you can buy the film. Critics are calling outrageous, original, wildly entertaining, and you get over 35 minutes of bone-crushing extra features. And it's available at participating retailers. It's rated R from Paramount Pictures. And I got to tell you, I've seen the movie. Jack Quaid is great in this film. I think it's a really fun, thrilling ride that is, though the trailer kind of gives a little too much away, it's a really great ride. And it's a lot of fun. And we're going to give a few copies away. So if you're interested in winning a copy of Novocaine, you can enter, send an email to contests@thehollywoodoutsider.com. It's contests@thehollywoodoutsider.com with your name and the subject line. It hurts so good. Yep, that's what I'm going to go with, the subject line and your name. And we'll draw randomly and we'll notify the winners. There you go. Novocaine.
I'm not opening that mailbox.
I probably don't want to. And also, our show is independently funded, and therefore all the expenses are from our own pockets. Patreon helps fans support their favorite podcast. And once you sign up, you get immediate access to all the content in your respective tier. And if you support the show, just go to patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. And John, is there anything you're going to be doing anytime soon? Do you know?
For those who might remember, I actually host a small little show for just our Patreon listeners called the Half Hour Power Hour, where me and my buddy Scott, you know Scott, we've talked about him. He's been here a couple times. He may have been here a lot in the past. Me and my buddy Scott sit down and we have a fun little conversation about whatever the show is. Right now, we're doing The Last of Us. That's the one we're really into at the moment. And we sit down and we do basically as quick of an episode as we can, recapping the show, talking about the recap, and really having a good time at it. So we're going to be doing it weekly, and I hope you guys take the time to engage with us and have some fun with it.
There you go. Patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider.
It's going to be a good time.
Am I coming on Sunday? Or am I not coming on Sunday?
No, you're coming in the weekend that I'm not here.
Okay. So I can't come on Sunday?
He doesn't want you there when he's there.
I'm getting that.
That's what okay. I heard. You know what? Let me talk to my other half and see whether or not you can come be on the show with us. How about that?
This is great fight for everybody listening. It's just a stellar debate.
I am hella excited to see how they do season 2.
All right, I'll tell Scott you're coming for the whole show then.
And now Troy just backed up. Whoa. I said Sunday. Whoa. I did not say the whole show. I did not. All right. Now let's go to our From the Outside In topic. What is it about hospital TV? It has made a resurgence again. There's always been medical TV shows, Marcus Welby, MD, you know, all the way back to those days. And then we had ER. And apparently Saint Noah Elsewhere. Wiley's in all of them. He's just, you know, officially in all
He's
of them.
He's a legit doctor now.
He is. Man, there's a okay, side tangent.
Yeah.
There's a great video where he's going through, and I think Amanda sent it out. I don't know. But, you know, there's a great video where he's actually touring an ER and he meets a doctor who asks him to sign his board certificate because he means so much. He meant more to him than the board certificate did because he's the one that made him want to be a doctor. And I think that's awesome.
That's crazy. That's that is awesome. Very cool, though.
There was also the rumor about how Noah actually like stitched up like the stunt coordinator's finger or something. I can't remember. It was somebody on the set.
He said he won't.
And he won't confirm or deny.
Confirm or deny. His mom was a nurse, too.
That's good.
I know how that feels. My mom was a nurse.
Can you stitch up people's fingers?
Yep, I sure can. I can. Do you want me to? Do you want to rip one open and I'll show you how it's done?
Yeah.
I'll suture it. Yep.
Let's do it.
It'll be like Adventures in Babysitting. It'll be like one stitch.
Yeah. My mom was very instrumental in making sure I was not afraid of needles. I wasn't afraid of any kind of tests. I had to look everything up when I thought I had something. For a while, that was a little bit of a problem.
So your mom gave you...
made me a hypochondriac a little bit. Yeah,
your mom while. Made you a hypochondriac. Here's Google. Go have fun.
No, not
also
Google.
How you ended up with books. Two kids because he was looking up.
Yeah. She didn't get through to me on the safe sex conversations. But anyway, so hospital TV. They've made a comeback. So now you've got, you know, Grey's Anatomy has never left, but the wake that they left kind of thinned out for quite some time. And now you've got them coming back at a huge influx, right? So I guess I kind of want to know from you
I'm
guys.
I'm so glad you said this because I've been like waiting all day to be like, no, you're wrong.
About which part?
About it making a comeback.
You don't think it's making a comeback?
I don't think it's making a comeback. I think it's been there for a long time and we're just...
Well, it slowed down, right? It wasn't, they weren't as popular for a while. It was all cop shows and Fire Country or whatever the hell, NCIS, X2P.
It's still classified as a medical TV, though.
What is?
Like 911 Lone Star, 911, Station 19. They're still considered, Virgin River is considered a medical TV show.
Are they really, though?
Yeah. By genre, just saying.
Didn't they only just start coming out post-COVID, though, the ones you're describing?
No,
those were out before.
Like, it was really interesting, like going back and taking a look at this. So, in 2021, there was one new medical drama show in 2021. Obviously, okay. That was the impact of the pandemic, right? But if you go back and look at history, there's an average of three new medical dramas that drop every year.
Because everybody's trying to chase that Grey's Anatomy or ER heat, right?
Correct. Even before Grey's Anatomy, there were still like an average of three a year that were dropping. And that's only in USA and Canada, in North America.
So you've been waiting for me to say this all day so you can tell me I'm wrong? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah, it sounds an awful lot like he's telling you your topic is bullshit right
now.
Well,
it's not. It's not.
No. Medical shows are still very prominent because right now, as of 2025, there are currently 11 medical dramas actively airing on TV right now. That's why it seems so prevalent.
Because it has made a resurgence, right?
Yeah.
Right.
See? It's factual. It's a good point. It's a good point. And I will say, like, I have seen more conversation, and I will acknowledge so people understand. I am fully aware that Michael Crichton's family and estate is suing the producers of The Pit, saying it's too close to ER, because originally Noah Wiley and those producers, John Wells, were moving forward with an ER reboot and decided to do The Pit instead. Michael Crichton's estate saying, hey, it's a little too much like ER. You're kind of ripping off. So I'm acknowledging that. I'm taking that out of it because I don't think that's pertinent to our conversation.
Here's an idea. That's how hospitals work across the country, okay?
And it's a trauma center, not an ER. Yeah. So different.
Yeah. You know? And it's done a completely different way because it's actually following 1 hour of a 15-hour shift over 15 episodes. It's the 24 model.
So what you're saying is 24 has a right to be like suing people.
Though. Sure. That's what I'm saying.
That makes total sense. Sure. Like, I don't want anybody to get sued. I just want to talk about hospital TV. So I will tell you, I don't like hospital shows or medical dramas. I don't like them for very specific reason. Historically, so I'm speaking in generality, right? Because as a kid who grew up with mom's a nurse, and this is John, where I say my mama told me this, you know, but no, I grew up, I've talked about this before. I grew up very, very poor. I was a latchkey kid. So I would often like go visit my mom in the hospital, at the hospital, and watch her deal with patients, or my Aunt Val. She was an ER nurse for most of her career, and watch her deal with patients. Or anytime I went to the ER, I made sure to go where Val was. So I've observed it countless hours, hundreds, thousands of hours, right, over the course of my life. And I just don't like how inaccurate they are. They're just bullshit TV most of the time. Grey's Anatomy, everybody's humping. Like, it's more about who's dating who than it is medical care, you know, things like that. They'll have a case of the week or a couple of things, but that's about it. Shows like House, I'll watch that one because it's Sherlock Holmes with medical mystery, so I can dig that. But again, the drama was ridiculous. That doctor would have been fired and sued into oblivion.
Oblivion.
Yeah, thank you. So I just have a really, really hard time watching them because they're packed with TV drama, melodrama. They're just overbrewing with it. The Pitt, I will say, is the closest thing I've seen to what I remember. Even the show ER wasn't this close. It just never was. And I liked the first few years just because I liked George Clooney's haircut. You know, it was pretty badass. But I didn't stick with ER. I would just kind of watch it occasionally as background noise. The Pitt, I put it on. I made it through all the episodes in a weekend because it was riveting. And it was done very, very well and kind of like stayed away from a lot of the drama I don't like and I don't care about. So that's where I stand on them. Now, Troy, you've watched them as long as I've known you. So why do you like about them? What do you love about them?
I mean, I like the medical drama shows mostly for the stories. Like, I love it when on Grey's Anatomy, there's a story that might arc three episodes or so because you're like actually getting invested in the patients. Mm-hmm. And I feel that gets you closer to the doctors and unfortunately not the nurses, because one of the problems with medical shows for the most part is that there isn't one about the nurses.
I agree.
It's always the doctors doing everything. The doctors don't do anything. The nurses do a lot of the stuff. So they need to have a show where the nurses are doing all the work. I think Carla is probably
that's much
the
more
most
factual. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of friends that are nurses. My sister's a nurse. So yeah, like something that focuses on that. That's probably why I like Scrubs so much, because Carla was so important to the show. And like, and oh my gosh, who is Carla's counterpart? Drawing a blank. R. John, you can help me out as I keep thinking. But the big thing I think with those shows is that I get invested in the patients, because when you're invested in the patient's story, then you can feel what the doctor's feeling or feel what the nurse is feeling or feel what, you know, the family is feeling. And I think that's what ties you in, is you get that pull on the heartstrings kind of thing. And The Pitt, I think, is doing a pretty great job. I mean, I've only seen the first episode, but I have a friend who finished the finale this past Sunday, and they said that they actually do a really great job throughout the entire show, really talking about the medical, the mental toll that it takes on the medical worker.
Mm-hmm.
And they really showcase that a lot right from the jump in the first episode. Not that he actually jumps, but
Jesus.
They literally are up on a roof having a conversation at the end of a shift and
about jumping.
And it's like, yeah, it's hard, you know, when you go through that, like, you know, trying to save somebody, you know, all day long, and then finally pass away at the end of your shift. And it's just like, it's brutal, you know, to have to go through that day in and day out.
You spend so much time trying to save them, and then you lose them.
Yeah. Especially when you hear about the story about the guy in the first episode that he was trying to save and his backstory.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, I feel for a character that I never saw. Like, that's a good show.
Mm-hmm.
That can make you feel for a character you never actually even see on the screen. Like, that's good stuff.
Hospital shows always hit on a very specific nerve. They give you life and death in every single episode. You have urgency, emotion, human vulnerability. These are all things that we as viewers can latch onto, and that's why they become very important to us. You can have a very emotional catharsis from watching them. You have that tension and release from life and death failures, and a sense of routine is also a big part of these shows that really help some people get into them, and that's why they really work. For me, it's been... I would say that I understand why some shows survive as long as they have and some shows didn't. Like ER lasted for as long as it did because it kind of vacillated back and forth between the medical side of it and the emotional side of it, or the melodrama side of it, very, very deathfully. And it did so in a way that kept people engaged. Whereas you have Grey's Anatomy, who when
won't
the...
Won't die.
Right. And it, you know, at the same time of Grey's Anatomy, you had House, and House kind of like decided to leave because there's only so much of that story you can tell before you start getting way too melodramatic. And so that's why they ended the show when they did. But then you have Grey's Anatomy that just leaned into the melodrama because by that point we were all exhausted with medical shows. And so it became more about the melodrama, more about these characters and the ridiculous things they get into. So that's why Grey's Anatomy has lasted for as long. And ever since, we have been looking for that thing that help us along and get us further into medical shows. And some things pop up here and there, sure, but COVID kind of made us very tired and weary of medical shows. So then, Grey's Anatomy leans even more into the melodrama, and then now, because we're starting to be as people much more interested in caring and engaging with one another and empathy and all these things, that makes a medical show the perfect place to start breeding some of these emotions that we're looking for. So that's why I think we're seeing this resurgence of medical shows and exactly the themes that they're going with as far as how they're carrying forward.
And I suppose you could say there was a slight resurgence because in 2020, there was no new medical show, no new medical drama released in 2023. So after one in 21, two in 22, none in 23, then there was two in 24 and three in 25.
See? Resurgence. Popping. Well, because you have to clear the COVID time, right? Because you don't want to make a medical show. People were kind of polarized on the whole topic, so they kind of backed away from it. It became political. It became freaking political. Healthcare became politicized. And, you know, it just became something where TV didn't want to touch it because,
At the height of the pandemic in May of 2020, right, there were 10 medical dramas actively airing at the height of the pandemic still.
You know, I think that people watch them for the characters. They didn't watch them for the medical part. It's kind of like the NCIS and NYPD Chicago shows. Yeah, people, and maybe Law and Order people watch for the cases, but everything else people are watching for the characters. Yeah. That's what they care about. And I do think COVID burned people out on the concept for a little bit. You know, they just got skittish about it. And especially all the politics. Healthcare should never be political. It should never be politicized. You should never throw your party into the conversation. It doesn't matter.
I mean, that's why they had to take all the medical stuff now and move it onto a boat.
Is that Dr. Odyssey? Is that what you're talking about?
That's such a guilty pleasure for me to watch.
What is this show about?
It's the Love Boat, but more focusing on the doctor of it all. It is dumb. It is dumb, 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 dumb. And I have to watch it every week.
Yeah, you don't want to eat at the captain's table. You want to eat at the doctor's table.
Yeah, you want to eat the. You know what? You want to get his cast off for sure.
Is this really like? Is that what it's about? It's just about ship doctors. Is that what we're?
It's one ship doctor and his two nurse practitioners that help him on the ship. And there's quote unquote different medical mysteries every single week. They're not that much of mysteries. Just they're
he
just
ate
really.
The chicken.
Like,
is it like that?
It's kind of, in some cases it's that, in other cases it's you know, oh, you have, what is it, the case this last week, this girl had that her blood produces too much iron, so they had to do like they're worried about whether or not what she had, so they had to start doing bloodletting. Meanwhile, these other two girls on spring break brought in fentanyl laced cocaine, and on top of that, one of them has
that get through security.
Yeah, I don't know. And then on top of that, one of them has like this chamber in her heart that like all of us have, but didn't close up from when she was a baby. So like when she went scuba diving, she came back up and had the bends, even though she didn't go that deep. It is stupid. It is the dumbest fucking show, but I can't stop watching it.
Well, let me tell you, I've been on a cruise ship and needed medical attention, and they were nowhere to be found. I literally went to where they said to go, and there was nobody there. They said, just wait or leave a note. And I'm not making that up. They actually had sticky notes and said, leave a note. I'm like, I got to leave a sticky note. And then somebody will get back to me. And no one got back to me. No.
That's not a HIPAA violation at all.
I had to write it out. had to ride it out.
If you were on this boat, they would have not only, they would have gotten to you lickety spickety spickety, you know, they would have been right there on top of you.
Say that again. And three times.
Literally on top of you.
I gotta watch that now. Just for shits and giggles.
Just for it's Josh. So just for Josh Jackson. Joshua Jackson.
Sean Connery all of a sudden.
Just watch my friend Josh Jackson. He's amazing.
All right. So what, here's my question specifically for you, Troy. For you. You have watched Grey's Anatomy since day one.
Yeah.
And it's just a soap opera, as far as I can tell. I don't watch it, so it's, maybe it's an unfair statement. Do you watch it for the medical portions of it, or is it just, I get the completionist aspects, but is it more because of the characters?
Oh, no. It's definitely the completionist aspect now, for sure.
So because, you don't even care what happens anymore. You just have to watch it.
Well, there are three characters on the show, maybe four, that I'm still tied to. So like when all of those four characters go, then I might be done. And one of them left at the end of the fall finale last year. And I was just like, oh my God, no, not, I was not prepared. But there's two more for sure that are like that. And there's like two bonus characters after that, that if those people go, then I'd be done.
Is Dr. Gray still on it?
Yep.
Because she kind of has to be, right? I mean, it's Gray's anime.
Here's my theory is that they're holding out to like, they won't end the show until they find a cure for Alzheimer's, right? And at this point, Meredith's going to get Alzheimer's before she actually cures it. So
technically, she's going to find a cure, because she's just going to forget that she was looking for it.
The cure. God, it's going to suck. She's going to be like in the lab, 72 years old, and going, I found it, and I just forgot.
Nope.
It's going to be Newhart, where she like literally like has flashbacks of like the first day when she met McDreamy.
Oh, my God. He'll look the same. He'll still be Sexiest Man Alive.
Totally.
So now that
I mean, it's background fodder for me at this point. It's not awful. It's definitely not medical, for sure. Not medical at all. It's definitely for some of the characters that I've just been attached to for, 20 years.
Well, I got to tell you, I really just don't watch medical dramas of any kind. A lot of it is, it really just, I'll be honest, a lot of it infuriates me when I watch it. Okay, so when I was growing up, and I would go to the hospital and I would sit on the floor. I would watch my mom, and she was a nurse, and she worked medical and then she worked psych. So she's worked on both sides of that, different kinds of health. And in both cases, she would get assaulted, insulted, accosted, brutalized. She would come home with bruises. She would come home with cuts, and she would come home just horribly down. I mean, she's dealing with stress and pain and death and anger and mental health issues, and then medical health, like all the time, right? So it's constant stress, and still be very affectionate, warm for me, and just a wonderful mother all around. And then we get up the next day, go back and deal with that nonsense all over again for a long time, not for great money, right? She did it because she cared about people. I remember once when I was a kid, teenager, and we were still pretty poor, doing better, but still poor. And she was offered a 6-figure job, which was a huge deal. She'll never tell you this story. She was offered 6 figures. That was a lot of money back then. And I'm like, go. What are we even talking about? Like, I'm just looking at the houses and I'll get a new car. Maybe I'll get all this kind of stuff. And she turned it down because she cared more about helping mental health patients at the time. And there was nobody that was really wanting to do that because there's no money in it. And so she turned down like, That's to me what a healthcare professional, like someone who really, and I've met tons of them over the years because of her. Those are the people that I think need to be more represented in television and aren't. And that's why I don't watch a lot of them, because the doctors get all the glory. They do everything, which is not the truth. Nurses do way more than doctors come in for 2 minutes and then walk out in a normal everyday setting in a hospital. Nurses are doing tons. That's why I really liked In the Pit, and I think it was in the first episode where he tells the doctor,
she's the most important person.
Yeah. Do what the nurse tells you. Yeah. Because they know what they're talking about. I love the charge nurse. Yeah. So, I mean, that's why I haven't watched it, and I have a hard time watching them because they bug me, because they're not really a true representation of what it's like. And, you know, you already have people that can Google something, so they think they're doctors. So they're constantly, you know, doubting medical advice, and they're constantly questioning it, even though you came into them, that kind of stuff infuriates me. And I guess that's why I'm all that to say the Pit is one that I would say is the best one I've seen thus far, because it feels the closest to what I've witnessed. And I'm not saying it's the truest in the world, but it feels the truest to what I've seen. What I've seen nurses go through, what I've seen doctors go through, what I've seen orderlies go through. I mean, it really kind of paints a fair picture of what their day is like. And they're just trying to get through their shift without breaking down, because it's constant. I mean, you have to be so strong to deal with all that. And they don't really ever give you a good understanding of what that's like as a professional.
Except for episode 2.
Of
The Pit.
Why?
My nurse friend was like, yeah, wait till you see episode 2. They're doing compressions on this one person. And the fact that they actually like let this thing air is so wrong, because the dude's like twerking the entire time he's doing the compressions. It's completely incorrect the way that the compressions are being done.
Well, they've got to make it. They can't actually do the compressions. They'll snap a human being's chest.
Well, no, they put a mannequin on the table.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and see it. There are different ways to do compressions, by the way.
For sure.
Yeah, there are different ways to do them.
But, you know, for me, like the show that I always go back to when I think of great medical shows, and I know I've talked about it before because it is one of my comfort shows whenever I'm in a bad mood, but it's Scrubs, because we've had like Dr. Dan's been on the show with us, and Dr. Dan's been like, that's what been one of my favorite medical shows, because he feels like that to some degree they get it more right than the other shows. And then you mentioned the shows. I mean, Troy mentioned earlier,
it's how Dr. Scrubs. Stan.
Oh, right. Dr. Stan. He's not going to be upset about the fact that I got his name wrong. Ever, huh?
I was actually going to bring him on for this episode, but we ran short of time.
Stanley Daniels. That's what it is. That's why I messed it all up.
I knew what you were saying. It's fine.
Yeah. Anyhow, but on Scrubs, they do talk about the nurses are the ones that you go to if you ever need, you're ever in trouble. They'll know more than you ever do. And it's Nurse Roberts.
Yes. Thank you.
Nurse Roberts. But they found a way to bleed comedy into some serious situations, almost to a degree. If you look at it, if you subtract the comedy in such a way, you can actually see that they're using comedy to manage these very highly stressful situations, these scary things that are happening, and they're overloading the comedy so that they can make a show that's watchable, but still teach you about the emotional weight that happens in these hospitals. And you can see that in episodes like there's the there's My Mistake. Yeah. That's a great episode right there where you talk about the death.
No, you can't talk about it. It's like that one episode of television that everybody needs to watch if you ever want to learn how to write television. It is like the best episode.
It is a beautiful episode.
What about you, Troy? Which show did it best?
The best? I mean, so far The Pit seems very well done from the two episodes I saw. I love Scrubs. I mean, it just felt real for some reason. Like you got, it's my buddy I went to medical school with, and now we're doctors, but he's a surgeon and I'm a, you know, general practitioner, and like he's such a bro dude and I'm not a bro dude, and like and just trying to find who you are and how to be a doc. Like that Scrubs like really spoke to me when it was on. I loved House just from the whole Sherlock Holmes aspect of it and figuring it out, which is why I gave The Resident a chance. Granted, Emily Van Camp was on there, and I like watched everything Emily's done over the years. But the concept of The Resident, just having that House feel in a medical show where they also talked about fixing the system and like how bad the hospital was run and everything, and they end up selling to a company, and there's a lot in The Resident that I thought was really good until like maybe the fifth season, and then it just kind of like fell off, which I think it only had 6 total from what I remember.
House Grace was only great. Like, I just want to point out, House only got it right after like the 6th attempt. He was sure 5 other times in every episode, and then he finally gets it right at the end. Like, you're not so brilliant. Like, you've already stuck everything in their holes. I mean, eventually you're going to get something right.
Compared
to The Pit, where House is at least doing something for the people of The Pit, that people are sitting out in the waiting room and dying in the waiting room.
Oh, they're not. That's how real waiting room. You always have to wait if you're not really sick. Here's an idea. Go to a walk-in clinic.
Charges you way less money. And you can sign up online so you know when your position is online, so you don't actually have to go to the walk-in clinic until you actually like, hey, you should come to the clinic now.
There is a real truth that if people have insurance that is provided to them, they will go to the ER.
rather than a walk-in clinic. That is, and I know that's, it's always seen as like taboo. You can't say that because it's looking down on poor people. And I was poor. I mean, I get it, but it's a fact. It just is. I've been in multiple ERs. I'm telling you, that's pretty normal.
Do you know what the longest running medical drama is?
Mm-mm. Marcus Welby be my guess.
You'll never guess.
Okay. ER.
No, because Grey's Anatomy made sure that they went more episodes in ER. That was the first reason why Grey's Anatomy stuck it out to whatever episode it was, 400.
Okay, is there one longer than Grey's Anatomy?
There's one longer than Grey's Anatomy.
Marcus Welby, that's be my guess. Or MASH.
No, it's not. Not even MASH.
Okay. Not even MASH.
All right, what?
Still airing today, started in 1963.
Dr. Pimple Popper.
General Hospital.
Oh, come on, that doesn't count.
That, I don't know if that counts, my friend.
That doesn't count. Does that count?
It's on the official list as medical drama.
All right.
I don't know you if know that what? Can count.
Hey, it doesn't have to be good. It just has to be on.
It has to be on. 5 days a week.
Can it be at least? It needs to be at least 5% about a hospital.
We could just make the argument it's not a primetime TV drama.
It's not a primetime TV drama. Yeah. No, Grey's Anatomy would be the longest running at this point.
USA. How long was ER was on for? 20 years, right? 20 something?
20 years.
ER was 94 to 2009.
24 years then.
15 years.
15 years. Wow.
Yeah. Math is hard. Yeah.
Got it.
Should look that up when your mom was teaching you stuff.
My mama said 2 + 2 = 3.
Heard the year wrong, dickhead. All right. Whatever.
But like Chicago Fire and Chicago Med are still going strong. 911, I never thought that show would still be on the air, but 911 is still going. And
are we calling that a medical drama then? We are calling it that.
It's called a medical drama, yeah. Because they're doing medical things, but it's literally all three aspects, right? Medical, fire, and police are all involved.
Okay, fair enough.
Would you say fully involved? Very few people got that bit.
Did you make a Foley catheter fully involved, like a Foley catheter joke?
No, it's a...
Because that would have been funny if you actually meant Foley catheter.
But. No, it's a firefighter saying. So when you say something is fully involved, that means it's like really on fire or something like that.
Yeah. Well, see, this isn't a fire show. This is a medical show. So a Foley involved.
I want to mention some of... listener picks, I was asking them the same question, and everybody seems to say the Pit. So Pit is really... And that could be some recency bias, because I do think ER is very similar. Sorry for your lawsuit. But Kyle Nolan said something I agree with very much. He said, I like when it's actually about the medical drama. The Pit was great. And also recently enjoyed Doc, which I haven't seen, but I've heard good things. He says, I can't stand when it becomes all about the hookups among the staff. Amen. That's my biggest problem with the medical dramas. As it ultimately ends up being... After a season or two or three or four, whatever, it ends up being just all about who's dating who instead of the patients.
Or started that way from the beginning if you're watching Heart of Dixie.
Sure. If you happen to be watching a show I don't even know if I know exists.
Oh, you know which one I really... Oh, yeah. This one I really like because it was a small town medical practice and that was dealt with like... he lost his wife and the kids were there. Everwood.
Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman?
No, Everwood was really good.
I like Doc Hollywood. That was a fun movie.
Doc Hollywood was a great movie.
Yeah, I like
that. That's a great movie.
All right. Well, that's enough for this topic. Let's move into our whole game, which is going to be this or that. John, you give us two movies or two TV shows, either one, to determine. And we're going to tell you which is the best of those. Troy and I are going to fight about this, and we're going to tell you which is best.
90s thrillers icons. Okay?
Okay.
Seven versus Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, okay. That's a good little battle there. One won Best Picture, one did not. So we got that going for it. One won Best Actor, the other did not. One was Best Actress, Best Director, Best Screenplay. I feel like Silence of the Lambs is going to win, rightfully so. That's my pick.
But really, Troy? Aaron, what's in the box?
I'm with you, but I mean,
It's probably one of like the most suspenseful moments. Like, what is in the box?
But as a whole movie, it doesn't compare to Silence of the Lambs.
No.
It just doesn't.
And we're not saying that because we're like snooty Academy Award people and follow Oscars and stuff.
You're not my supervisor. I mean,
it sounds an awful lot like that's exactly what he's saying.
You're not my supervisor. No, I just think it's a better movie.
Are you quoting Severance like that?
No, that's not Severance. That's Archer.
That's Archer.
That's Archer. Sir. Not everything is Severance. My God.
That's how you get ants, Troy. That's how you get ants.
No, it's got to be Silence of the Lambs.
It's got to be Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, it's got to be. What, okay. Did you have a pick? Did you have a preference?
No, I didn't have a preference. I just wanted to go with whatever was like those two. Those are two very prominent thriller icons for the 90s. And
two great villains, by the way. I mean, yeah. John Doe is a great villain, but it just doesn't compare to Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter. Like, he was just, especially that movie. That movie, he's phenomenally ferocious.
He's good in most all of his stuff, though. I mean,
yeah, he's not a bad actor. I think he's going to be all right. He can do some stuff.
He's doing some stuff in voiceover.
Yeah.
It's because he's getting old, man. He can't get out of the house anymore. He's like, just give me the voiceover jabs. I can do those.
You know what? Listeners, on the Facebook post for this episode, you give your vote. What do you think is the better movie for a 90s thriller icon? Seven or The Silence of the Lambs? I'd like to see what you guys have to say.
Pretty sure I just answered it. But you go ahead. Do whatever you want, man. That's fine. Make your own show. Whatever.
I'm just going to do my own show.
All right.
Apparently everybody's entitled to their opinion.
I disagree. That's what Aaron said. Disagree. All right. So let's go to some upcoming attractions. Coming out on April 18th is Sinners. Oh, I can't wait for this, man. The reviews, it started to release early to critics and whatnot, and I've heard nothing but phenomenal reactions. Michael B. Jordan, and even though it's got something I don't like in it, but Michael B. Jordan and director Ryan Coogler reteam for a horror action combo, trying to leave their troubled lives behind, twin brothers. But I'm getting over it because I love Ryan Coogler. Twin brothers return to their hometown to start again, only to discover that an even greater evil is waiting to welcome them back. Psst, vampires.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
It looks good.
I was really watching the trailer and I said aloud, I was like, oh my gosh, Aaron's going to hate this. And then it was like, directed by Coogler. Aaron's going to love this.
Yep. I don't know what to do. So we'll see how it works out. Twins against twins, I'm sure. I hope Danny DeVito shows up. The Wedding Banquet. A gay man, huh? That's a joke. Nothing? All right. A gay man makes a deal with his lesbian friend, a green card marriage for him in exchange for in vitro fertilization treatments for her. Plans evolve as Min's grandmother surprises them with a Korean wedding bouquet. Stars Bowen Yang, Lily Gladstone, and Kelly Marie Tran. And someone will probably be deported by the end of it. Ba-dum-bum-ba-dum-bum.
Sounds like a joke.
Welcome to America.
Gay Get man makes out. A deal with a lesbian. A gay man, a lesbian, and a vampire walk into a bar.
So that's theater. Troy, what's coming out on TV and streaming?
Yeah, because there is no such thing as broadcast TV anymore. So most of the stuff's probably coming on streaming or cable if people still have HBO. Because the only thing you should be watching, the only thing you should be watching on Sunday night is The Last of Us Season 2. Mm. It drops literally 2 days after you're hearing this episode. Also, Law and Order, Organized Crime. That's right. If you ever wanted to know how Chicago and New York work, just watch Peacock on April 17th. Leverage Redemption Season 3 is coming back to Prime on April 17th as well. Then we also have Ransom Canyon coming to Netflix. Secrets, Love, and Lies intertwine as Ranch and Staten Kirkland follows his heart, fights to protect his land, and investigates a painful personal loss.
It's like Yellowstone for Netflix. That's what it is.
It's exactly what it is. And, of course, right on the heels of The Last of Us Season 2, the other must-watch of April is the second season of Andor on that one service that you may have to subscribe to again, Disney Plus.
Nah.
Troy, you liked that one, though, right? Did you like Andor?
Andor was everything that Aaron has ever asked for in Star Wars, something that had nothing to do with Skywalkers.
I need to go try that one again. That is one I will rewatch. I will give it another shot.
It is a great political drama.
I watched one or two episodes and I'm like, I didn't like the lead. I didn't like him in the movie. I didn't like him in the show.
It's painfully slow, but once you get to Mon Mothma and like what the rebellion is actually setting up as and the backstory of all of that, it's a lot better.
Okay. All right. All right. And I saw The Amateur, or Amateur, if you will.
Amateur. When his bosses at the CIA do very little to avenge the death of his wife at the hands of terrorists, a decoder takes it upon himself to become a technician of an assassin, using his skills to murder those who kill his wife. Stars Rami Malek, Rachel Brosnahan, John Berthnall, Lawrence Fishburne. Oh my God, why have I not seen this yet?
You would like it. It's very analytical in terms of the murder.
Okay, so is it a revenge tale, as we talked about, or is it more spy thriller, and does the cast work?
It is more revenge tale. It's a little ridiculous, but he's using more of his intellect to try to get into the mindset of a killer for a good portion of the movie, for at least the first half of the movie. And then you see him using his intellect to take out his enemies as opposed to As opposed to the typical revenge tale where it's just like shooting. Like, it's painfully obvious from his training. He trains with Lawrence Fishburne. He can't hit the broadside of a barn. Like, he's terrible with a weapon. So he has to use his intellect and create weapons. Now, I really stress that you don't watch the trailer. The trailer gives so much of the movie away. A lot of the cool things that happen to the villains is shown in the trailer. I hate that I have to tell people that. But if you've avoided the trailer, it's worth skipping it and watch the movie cold.
I mean, this also sounds like a joke, like Freddie Mercury, Mrs. Maisel, and Morpheus walk into a bar.
Jesus.
I kind of want that movie now. Oh, that would be great. I love it. And The Punisher shows up. Yeah.
Are they good? I mean, Rachel hold her own? Does Raimi hold his own?
Yeah. Like, I mean, Rachel Brosnahan is mostly in flashbacks because, you know, she's the wife. She's
kidnapped. Yeah.
I don't want spoiler alert, but she dies. And Rami Malek, I think, is a good actor. And I think I get he won the Academy Award. I just don't think of him as an Academy Award. I don't think he's as strong as a lot of other actors of his ilk, but he's a good actor. And I think he does really well here. John Bernthal, don't even put his name in the credits. He's in two scenes and they mean nothing. I don't know why he's here. I feel like that's just a budget expense they didn't need. And he was just like passing through and somebody said, do you want to be in the movie? He's like, all right. Literally, he's in two scenes and they do nothing. They do absolutely nothing.
Maybe he did him for free. Maybe it was a friend of his.
I hope so, because he doesn't need to be here. There's no reason. Lawrence Fishburne is actually really kind of exciting because he is a CIA operative and he kind of tries to train him. And then he might have to go after him once it's, you know, they understand what's going on with him. So there's a cool conflict between those two because they like each other, but they're also kind of adversaries. So good performances across the board.
How come we never talk about the bad guys? Like, who's the bad guys in this?
They don't.
Where's their names?
They don't matter. This is one of those movies where they don't matter. They're only given exactly enough screen time for them to plead for their lives.
Got it.
Yep.
It's really about the Batman. And
yes, very much. It's about Batman building his toys, his wonderful toys. Yep.
Got it. All right. Well, as ridiculous as it sounds, does it work overall?
Yeah, I think it works as a whole. I don't think it's the best of its ilk. And it kind of is a little slow moving at times. I mean, I did the old watch check at least thrice. Never a great sign. But it's overall a good story. I think some of that had to do with I had seen the trailer and it gives so much away. So I knew where we were going in certain elements at certain parts of the movie. So if $10 is the full price of admission, I give it $6. I think it's worth a watch. It's just not going to blow your doors off.
I mean, it depends on how good his toy is. It might.
True. There might be some explosions in there. There might. All right, John, so you and I saw Drop, which is, if you don't know what it's about a widowed mother's first date in years, which takes this terrifying turn when she's bombarded with anonymous threatening messages on her phone during their upscale dinner. Drops, if you will, digital drops, leaving her questioning if her charming date is behind the harassment or who else in the restaurant could be. Because once she gets to the restaurant, it's a who's who of who could this person be. Essentially, she has a son at home with her sister who's babysitting, and someone takes them hostage, basically trying to force her to do an act. And I don't want to spoil what that means because the trailer gives so much of it away and I don't really appreciate that part of it. But anyway, we saw Drop and it's directed by Christopher Landon, who I love in terms of his work. He's done Happy Death Day, Freaky, Happy Death Day 2, and now Drop. So John, first up, the setup, you know, this whole idea. Did you like the concept of Drop? And did you know you could do digital drops?
Yeah, I didn't know digital drops were a thing. Like, maybe it's because I'm not an Apple person, but it's not something that happens to me on my phone in any way, or do I have any app that allows me to do that? So, no, I don't think it's a thing for me. Do I think it's cool? Yeah, sure. And is this a cool setup for this particular movie? I think it's a really great way to tell the story.
Yeah, I don't think this is feasible. I mean, I think there is a concept called AirDrop, and you know, Google has usually a drop is like a bug fix or something along those lines. So I'm not aware of this technology existing and the way that they use it. It feels like this is more of a future state kind of situation where someone can drop on your phone if you're in the remote area, and there's a factor of the technology in the film where you can identify who's near you by this technology. This is not something that I think is quite common. I mean, it feels like Pokemon, but with people.
Yeah, that That's probably pretty accurate, I think. And that's the second time today someone's mentioned Pokemon out of nowhere.
It's not out of nowhere, son. It's been popular for a long time. But regardless of how old we may or may not be, and maybe we just aren't aware of technology like this that actually exists, but I don't think it does because I work a lot with technology. But this is probably something that will happen. And it's kind of a cool idea, that the idea that someone can just drop something on your phone, a meme or a tweet or whatever, like some kind of message on your phone, and you can either accept or ignore it, etc. And so this starts happening at the restaurant when they're at dinner, and then they're trying to force her to do something dark. Do you like this whole concept as a plot device, I guess?
Very much like Manchurian Candidate, but different. It's very, very much high stakes way of telling the story. So it worked for me.
How is it like Manchurian Candidate?
I was thinking about the whole like using a sleeper cell kind of thing. And
okay. All right. I guess in that way. Sure.
Yeah. Was that the improper use of Manchurian Candidate?
Not. I mean, I feel like it was a reach, but you just made it work. You made it work. You stretched it out. Works all right.
I stretched it out. Okay. I made it fit in a square hole in a round peg, you know?
Essentially. Sure.
Yeah. But it is an interesting way of doing the story. I don't think it's anything in the way of new. I feel like we've seen stuff like this. Like, I was constantly reminded of, do you remember the Johnny Depp movie Nick of Time?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
So the whole premise of that is kind of the same thing, where he gets set up to do something that he's not supposed to be doing, and he's a completely normal person, but his daughter is being held hostage by Christopher Walken, which is scary by itself. And the other trick to that is that the movie feels like it's taking place. Well, the whole gimmick is that every minute of the movie is a minute of this guy's life.
Yeah, very much so. And that one's a real time thriller. This is, it's kind of that similar concept, right? Where you're just like forcing an innocent person to do the work for you and do the bad deed on their own. And you try to figure, and you're watching them try to figure out how to get out of this, how to not do whatever the bad deed is, and also figure out who is behind it. What I like about this is Christopher Landon is a very good director. He's done, like I said, Happy Death Day. Happy Death Day 2 as well. Wasn't a fan of that one, but I do like the first one quite a bit.
I love them both.
And Freaky. I love Freaky.
And well, Freaky is great.
I think Happy Death Day 3, they said, is moving forward officially.
Ooh!
So you can get excited with that.
I am excited.
But with this one, what I noticed throughout, especially the first hour, the last 20 minutes or so, the first hour and 10 minutes or so, the last 20 minutes are very high tension, ratcheted up action. Like you're everything that's been set up is paying off, right? So that last 20 minutes to a half hour is really riveting and it's fascinating. The first hour or so is very Hitchcockian, which you know is my sweet spot.
Yeah.
So the camera angles, the tension, the one single location, the innocent person caught up, you know, over their head, all that sort of thing. That's very Hitchcockian. It feels like this is his homage to Hitchcock in many ways as I watched it. And I watch a lot of movies that are Hitchcockian. So I know it when I see it. I'm telling you, that's what he's doing.
There's a lot of like camera play and lighting play that they do work with here that is amazing. Like there's a part of the movie where they're kind of like focusing on each individual person in the place and they light them in a specific way. Mm-hmm. Or when they pull away from her and pull through the glass of the restaurant and you're seeing her from inside the glass and they light her in a specific way so that it's just like her in the city, which was a beautiful shot. Mm-hmm. Such a beautiful shot. There are so many small things in this movie put it together in this beautiful way. And I think, yeah, you're right. It's totally a hats off to Hitchcock.
Which, you know, speaks to me. Megan Fahey, who plays Violet, she's the star of the movie. You also have Brandon Sklenar, who's Henry. He's really kind of rising up. He was in 1923 and It Ends With Us. And he's really an up and comer in a lot of respects. And it's quite fascinating because Violet is a character who survived domestic abuse. And so there is an undercurrent of that, which is weird that Brandon Sklenar, and It Ends With Us, is very much about that same kind of topic. So I guess he likes doing movies that support that cause. So Violet survived that. And now this is her first date after dealing with years of abuse. And now she's kind of being abused in a different way. So they kind of play off that motif. And I thought that was interesting, a little daring in terms of the storytelling aspect of it, because you're talking about a very triggering scenario for a lot of people, but I think they treat it with respect. So I didn't have a problem with it. And I think they play it off well.
Yeah, I think they play it off very well too. And I just love the fact that they played with her, with every aspect of her character. She was a fully formed character. She was the one
she was really deep.
Fully formed character on the stage or on the screen in front of us. Brandon was great, but like, he's very much a side character. Everybody is, for the most part, a side character. That's a fact, but because we spend so much time digging into Violet's character all the way through, and Megan Fahey played her very vulnerable, very caring, but also very strong, and I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, I do wish, if I had one critique, and I do have this critique. Well, I have two critiques. One, I think it takes a little bit too long to get to the final act. In some respects, like, you have to swallow a lot of logic, because I would have found a way out of this. I'm telling you right now, long time before it happens. But on the same token, like, I thought her character was exceptional in terms of it was fully realized, like you said, but nobody else was, like you said, like, mm-hmm. You have tons of suspects in this. Nobody else is a character. Everybody else is more a caricature. And it's probably the one kind of point to the movie. Just because I think you really could have fleshed Henry out. And they do him a little bit, but man, there's so many other characters that get no fleshing out of any kind. And that's, but this is a fun thriller. This isn't meant to be a deep dramatic dive into surviving abuse. This is meant to be a fun, taut, intense thriller. And that, it succeeds at that.
Yeah, absolutely. And to your point about the nobody else is really, actually, I think that was my point, that nobody else is really fleshed out that much. It's like the main character, the side character, plus a whole ocean of red herrings.
Yes. And I will say, cute and sweet as he is, I don't think her son is a very good actor, but it's okay.
Because he's only this many. He's this many.
I know. I'm just saying. Okay.
He's this many.
At times I'm like, yeah, what are we really fighting for here? You know what I mean?
Like what do you want? Do you want him to be like, I see dead people. Is that what you're looking for level. Somebody this many?
That level. They obviously found it once. Must exist again, right? It's out there somewhere.
I'm not convinced he wasn't 40 then.
He was. He sure seemed that way. So this is another Blumhouse movie, and I will say, like, I think we've covered the bases. It's really, I think, captivating from start to finish. It's tight. It's not exhaustingly long. It's about an hour and 40, hour and 35 minutes, something like that. That's the right length for a movie like this. And it was pushing the edges of how long it was going to begin with until it really amped up. And I will say the final act is fantastic. Like, it's great. The ending is it's a great ending. And that's what you want for a thriller like this.
Oh, and they did, what is that gun thing? I said it earlier this
Chekhov's
week.
Chekhov's gun?
They did Chekhov's gun really well in this.
They do it a couple times in here, actually. They do a couple of them.
The final time they did it, it was pretty great. So I really appreciated that. And it is a good time. It is a great sit. And it's your typical Blumhouse movie where you have actors that are up and coming who are about to do something big with their careers. Maybe, maybe not. But it's more about this, like, fine-tuned, great storytelling on a budget. And they do that very well.
Absolutely. So $10 full price of admission, what do you give Drop?
It's $6.50 for me.
It's $7 for me. Oh. I love a good Hitchcock movie. And again, the ending's fantastic. So it works. All right, Troy. So you and I saw The King of Kings, which should be in theaters now when you hear this episode. It releases on Friday, April 11th from Angel Studios. And it's based on The Life of Our Lord, which is Charles Dickens' short story where it's about the life of Jesus Christ. And Dickens is narrating the story to his son, Walter. And the movie kind of picks up that ground and runs with it, right? So you open with Charles Dickens, I believe, doing a Christmas carol live on stage, and his son Walter is being a bit unruly in the back, and the other two kids are getting just ignored, and his wife is getting frustrated with him, he's getting angry, and they end up having a little bit of a spat because his son has an overactive imagination, because his dad is Charles frickin' Dickens, which makes sense. And so when they get home, his wife tells him he's going to tell a story about the King of Kings. Not Excalibur, not this fantasy story, but the King of Kings based on the Bible, the greatest story ever told. And tells the story of Jesus. And this is all through animated form, right? So it's an animated movie, and it is Christian themed, obviously. If that's something that, that you're not with, then you just skip it. But if you are into these movies, I mean, it's really, it does a very interesting back and forth where he's talking to his son, Walter, and he's explaining the story, and he's trying to amplify the story and tell it like a storyteller in many ways, but sticking to the facts or the established facts from the Bible in the rise of Jesus Christ. So it's animated. It's a faith-based story, and it's also tied into Charles Dickens. All interesting parameters there. An interesting dichotomy of ideas. What did you think overall of how they decided to tell this?
Yeah,
King of Kings.
Really interesting, because I get into these stories and you just sit there and you go like, oh my gosh, is it going to be literally the child storybook Bible just put on the screen, and it's going to be very by the numbers and how we explain these things and push them through. And I got started with it, and it starts out with a fantastic opening of Ebenezer sitting at his graveside with the Ghost of Christmas Future. And you're like, wait, I thought this was going to be about Jesus. Like, why are we here? And it's like, then you learn about the whole Charles Dickens short story, and that this is actually Charles Dickens as the dad talking to his son, Walter, who is the kid, Walter Dickens, and the Dickens family. And that opening sequence and like understanding the Dickens dynamic and how they operate, and the way that the mom, the wife, is just, you know, very much like, oh, Charles, like, you should really be nicer to the kids. And, you know, you should really like talk about forgiveness and talk about, you know, how to use an imagination creatively. And I thought that was really sweet. It was definitely a different take on setting up the movie, because one thing I really love is theater. And so having Charles performing the Christmas Carol was actually kind of cool to see. And it really established the animation right out of the gate, I think, which was really the most important thing, because you could have really bad animation ruin a really good movie. And just the storm and the snow and how it's covering the gravestone and just that opening sequence was just like, wow, this is like DreamWorks, Pixar, almost level quality. Not quite, but really close. And so you're like, okay, this is going to be some good lighting, some good shadowing. They're going to have some really good, powerful moments when we get towards crucifixion and Easter and all that fun stuff. And I really like the transition into how the father and son are spending the time together. So it's like, oh, now it's got this whole Christmas, Christmas bride. Yeah, something like that. The princess bride, where, you know, the grandpa's reading to the sick kid. It's going to have that kind of feel. And I'm like, okay, I'm in for this, because now we're going to have the story of Jesus told in theatrical form, somehow tying in this concept of the kid likes kings. So how are we going to make it more fantastical? And then we went on the journey, and the journey was like really great at first, because you saw at points in time how they insert the dad and the son into the Jesus story. So as Jesus and the disciples are walking, the dad and son are walking with the disciples, or when they're feeding the 5,000, the dad and the kid are sitting on the hillside talking about the story as the story is happening around them. Those moments of the movie are absolutely fantastic. Towards the end of the movie, though, it just seems like that gets forgotten, and then it's a little bit rushed through the most important parts, which are obviously the crucifixion and the resurrection. So, like, a really strong start, and then I don't know if they just lost the way at the end for me specifically, because I just thought like the really powerful moments kind of missed a little bit.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of that is trying to avoid the brutality
right.
of that portion of the story, right? Because I feel like I see what you're saying in terms of rushed. I feel like it's more telling the story the way that a dad would tell it to a kid. And so it made more sense to me, and why some of it, I wouldn't say anything was omitted. It just wasn't as, you know, it's not Passion of the Christ with Pixar cartoons.
Right.
That would just be weird. And I think that's kind of, it seems like that's really what it's doing. And I like how they approach this in terms of, look, if you're not somebody who follows the Bible or is a Christian based in your own life or whatever, you probably won't ever watch this. But if you are someone who that's important to you or important to your life, and you want to kind of have something that you can watch that speaks biblically and your kids can enjoy it too, this is a good film for that. I mean, I think they do a very good job of telling this story. I don't think it's as good as, I think you referenced Prince of Egypt when we were talking.
Yeah.
I don't think it's as good as that one, but it is. And I was pleasantly surprised because the budget is low. I mean, it's, I think $15 million or something like that. It's a small budget film.
But it doesn't feel like when you watch it. The animation is pretty sharp. I it's not quite Pixar level, obviously, but it looks pretty good. And I was engaged the whole time, which is saying a lot for me. You know, I'm no lover of animated films, nor do I watch a lot of Christian-based stuff. But this is, I thought, a very solid way to do it. And if you're a parent and you want to kind of have something that you can enjoy over Easter weekend and you don't feel like watching Mel Gibson's version of Jesus getting pulverized on the street.
Or Charlton Heston for the 500th time.
Yeah, I can't with the Heston. I just can't. You damn dirty Christians. basically, I just can't with him. That's a reference to Planet of the Apes. Don't start taking that out of context. I thought it was really well done. I thought it was a very well done. I love to see films like this made for people that enjoy them. You know, there is a community, a big craving for Christian cinema. And if it's out there, then let them have it. I mean, you know, some people will probably chastise us for even talking about this, but I'm not going to be one of those people. It's a movie and we should watch it and enjoy it as a movie. And I think it does what it's intended to do. It's a good story and it's well told.
Yeah. They do really great job with specific events. I thought the animation during the Jesus and Peter walking on the water and the whole, like, you fell because you lost your faith and the way that whole...
Spoiler alert.
Totally. Well, they've been around for like 2,200 years.
What do you mean he fed all those people?
But yeah, like the Peter walking on water, the demon casting out into the pigs. Like, I thought those sequences were really great. And then you have the feeding of the 5,000. And this is probably one of the more popular stories like in the whole journey. And I was like, this was a chance, and this is me, right? Because we start off with the fantasticalness of theater, right? I was thinking the miracles were going to be a little bit more, the kid imagining the miracles to be more spectacular.
Because the kid is there a lot when the story's being told. Right. He's like, he's present because he's, you know, he's hearing it through his dad's voice. So he's on site basically with Jesus. He's not interacting with him, but he's on site with
him. Yeah, and I'm not talking like super fantastical, but like, the whole feeding of the 5,000, it's like they bring the loaves and the bread and then the camera pans away to the crowd. And then all of a sudden they're like handing stuff out. And I was like, where was the magic? Where was the theater? Where was the surprise? Here it is. You know,
it just kind of happens. And it still makes me wonder, those fish, they just definitely weren't safe. I'm just saying, like, they weren't cooked. I just feel like there should have been an open fire somewhere where someone could have, you know, there's bacteria, man, you know,
potentially. We won't get into specifics. the other one I thought that was kind of a miss was for me, like, those are like good stuff. The miss, I thought, there's two big ones for me. One is that the mother, or Mrs. Dickens, right, is like so involved in the beginning of the story.
And fades out.
The first people that get to see Jesus after the resurrection are the women, right, at the tomb. And I was like, what a great way to have mom, because mom comes in the middle of the story and brings like cookies or whatever right before the feeding of the 5,000, and that's how the boy stands up and gives
that's the transition.
Yeah, right. So what a great time for mom to come in and be like, hey, it's getting late, you know, maybe you guys should think about wrapping up the story. And then she could be brought back into the picture with the women at the tomb. So I thought like that was a miss for me specifically, having grown up with the stories. And then the one other one that's kind of like a thing is like when the boy sees Jesus after the resurrection, Jesus like touches his face, and as his hand comes out, I'm like, there's got to be a hole in the hand. And there wasn't a hole in the hand.
Again, this is a story being told to a kid.
I don't
want holes in the hand. I don't. If you get little Johnny sitting there, he's 4 years old, I don't need an oozing wound. I really don't think that's necessary to convey what they're telling.
I mean, it's just,
You want the more adult version of this cartoon. That's what you want.
Like, they did a great job when they're nailing him to the cross.
You want Walking Dead combined with an animated film or something.
I thought they did a great job when he's on the cross. They go to nail in his hand for the first time, how the hammer comes down, but they cut away at the last minute to the crowd doing the ooh. I think they did fine. It's like, but having a hole in the hand is kind of a big thing because that's the whole, the disciples see Jesus and they put his, he shows his hands and feet and, like,
what do you want? Like, you want it like the crow where he puts a hand in front of his face and he looks through it and he's like, oh, look at that. Like, what? I don't think that's necessary. I just don't. Wow. You want a different movie. No, that's what I'm thinking. Just,
there's small things like that. Like, if you're telling the story, you got to tell the story. You know, don't shy away from it.
Well, one thing that I will say that I didn't realize as we were going, because I don't check credits until something's over, typically, unless I already know. And I didn't know the voice actors, but here's the voice. I mean, Pierce Brosnan's in here. Kenneth Branagh is Charles Dickens. Uma Thurman is Catherine Dickens. Mark Hamill is King Herod.
King Herod's great, Ben too, Kingsley. By the way. I loved all the King Herod sequences.
Oh, man. Mark Hamill, one of the best voice actors, I think, that's ever done the job. Like, he's just so magnificent. And Jesus was Oscar Isaac. So Poe from Star Wars was Jesus. And he does a really good job. So it's a very strong cast. And one thing I actually appreciated is, rather than speaking tons in old Bible verses, right, which was told in a much different time.
Very plain language.
It's very plain language. So young kids can easily understand what's going on and what people are talking about. And it's a story. I mean, it's a story about forgiveness and, forgiving yourself and forgiving others and that sort of thing. Like, that's the story that's really being told or being enforced to little Walter. But when Dad's explaining it and all the characters are having their conversations and Jesus is going through his journey, all of that dialogue is understandable. It's not, "Oh, how hath thee risen again?" You know, that sort of thing. That's not how it speaks. I know one Bible verse and I don't remember it well enough to speak.
Yeah, in this case, it's about King of Kings. It's not about King James.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think it's well done. I think if you have families that want to go enjoy something and, you know, you want something safe and enjoyable for the whole family and you happen to be, a Bible enthusiast, if you will, this is going to be right up your alley.
And we should say thanks to Angel Studios at the end. They actually have a pay it forward campaign at the end of the movie where you can actually scan a QR code and then gift a ticket to the theater to somebody else that might not be able to go see it.
Yeah, they did that with Sound of Freedom too, and that was a big win for them. Like, they're really trying to get their Christian based content out there, and they're seemingly doing a good job of paying it forward. Like you said,
no, it's just good. It's good overall. Thoroughly enjoyable hour 45 minutes.
So if $10 full price of admission, what do you give The King of Kings?
I'd give it a $6.
Yeah, I'd go $6.50.
It's definitely watchable. It was a much enjoyable, great way to tell the story.
I felt like a little kid with my grandpa again, because my grandpa was a preacher. I don't tend to be very religious, but, I will still watch them and try to enjoy them for what they are. And I thought this does a very good job. And I understand, if you're a dad, this is or mom, this is a good way to have that story reflected to your kids.
Yeah. And something you can go see at the cinema and not have to worry about what they're going to see when they sit down.
That's right. And hopefully they don't do like Minecraft and every time, Jesus is being accosted, somebody's throwing popcorn in the audience or something. So,
well, I mean, I don't know. Jesus riding on the back of Peter, that might be interesting.
Wait, what?
With Jack Black rides on the back.
Oh, Chicken Jockey.
Chicken Jockey.
I'm like, what? You made this weirder. What are you talking about? All right. Let's go. Let's go to what you've been watching. Troy, we'll let you go first because you have not been here in a minute. So what is one thing you want to tell people? Hey, find this when you can, where you can.
Well, I know this one came out a few weeks ago, but we weren't here. We did some compilation episodes where it's South by Southwest, and then 600 hit. But I saw Mickey 17, and all I can say is that Mickey 17 is basically like if Starship Troopers was written by a kinky person.
Okay, what?
Because I'm just like, what is this?
Right, this is like the director of Parasite.
Yeah, yeah. So like, I'm like, what is going on here? Because the crux of the movie is really an allegory about capitalism and ruining the environment and the mental health of the workers that work for the machine is kind of what I got out of the movie personally. But they're basically trying to inhabit a planet and there are slug bugs on the planet and the Mickeys are basically what are called expendables. So they go out and they try different foods or they try different pathogens. They try to like work with the native environment. And if they die, who cares? We'll just print out a new Mickey. And they literally print out Mickeys over and over and over again until they get to Mickey 17, the name of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And 17 ends up falling down a crevasse. And when he's in the crevasse, the slug bugs actually save his life. So they think that he's dead and they print number 18. And so now 17 and 18 are basically having a battle of wits of who's going to be around because, can't have two of them because there's a rule against that in the corporate society.
Sounds like twins.
Kind of. But then the girlfriend has like a three-way with the two clones and they're talking about like Kama Sutra positions and it was just weird. But they find out obviously that the two of them exist. And so the great overlord of the colony basically wants to kill the slug bugs. So then it becomes Starship Troopers And each Mickey has to go with bombs strapped to their chest to basically go kill the hive of the slug bugs. So, but then obviously things change because as movies do. But overall, I thought it was good. It was a fun watch.
And what would you give that one? $10 for price permission?
$6.50.
All right. So it was enjoyable enough.
Yeah.
All right. And you've got one more. We'll come back to that. Let's do John's real quick.
Yeah. Last week on April 3rd, Amazon Prime dropped a little show that was only 8 episodes long. And each episode is a half hour long. It's called The Bondsman. It's an action horror series, and it stars Kevin Bacon as Hub Halloran, a seasoned bounty hunter who is murdered and subsequently resurrected by the devil. His new mission is to capture escaped demons from hell and return them back to hell. And throughout the series, Hub confronts his past mistakes, attempts to build relationships with his ex-wife, and his son, and ends up bringing his family into his demon hunting shenanigans. It's a bit of a fun show. It's right up there with I guess you can say Ash versus Evil Dead.
That's my first thought when I heard about it.
Yeah. It's right up there with those kinds of shows. It's a Blumhouse show as well, so it's got kind of a nice pedigree to it. Easy watch. It's not something that's going to make you do any heavy lifting. It's easy, kind of fun, really funny moments, and it's Kevin Bacon and doing his big Kevin Bacon thing. So $6.
All right. And Troy, you saw something that I've seen, but I'm curious what you think about it.
Oh man, I watched the first episode of The Studio. Oh my gosh, it was everything I wanted. It's so good. I was just like, yes, tell me what the inside of a studio is like and how all this stuff comes together and how it all works. And the premise is basically that Catherine O'Hara's character gets fired as the head of the studio. And so Seth Rogen's character gets promoted to be the head of the studio. And Bryan Cranston is like the big wig. Mm-hmm. And basically they're trying to say like Seth Rogen's character wants to make real films, you know, not movies. Bryan Cranston even has a line. It's like, we're not here to make films. We're here to make movies. And I was like, exactly right. Because they're trying to make an IP of the Kool-Aid Man.
I love that. I just love it.
It was so good. And then where it goes, like, you have to watch the episode. Because where it goes, I was on the ground laughing so hard when the pitch actually happens. And I'm just like, oh my God, no, this is not where it's going. It's so great.
It's so well done. And the second episode is the Wonder one where he's basically Seth Rogen interrupts a director trying to make a Wonder. It's a really fun show, like really shows you the inside of movie studios. And Seth Rogen said that everything that they talk about has been taken from something that was already talked to them about by a studio head over the years. So it's all real in different ways.
And no expense. I mean, in the first episode alone, I mean, not only do you have like Catherine O'Hara and Bryan Cranston and Catherine Hahn and Seth Rogen, right? But you also have Steve Buscemi is in there. Mm-hmm. Martin Scorsese is in there. Charlize Theron is in there. I mean, it's like stacked.
Charlize Theron. Fuck off.
One line. One line. And it was the best line ever.
It was great. Ah. All right. Well, I think that's
Apple TV, actually, by the way. Apple TV Plus.
You just reminded me of something real quick that I wanted to bring up.
If it's a show from 20 years ago, no, John, we're not doing it.
No, it's something I thought was interesting because of The Pit. There are two people in The Pit who are the children of two very well-known actors.
Oh.
I know Fiona Dourif, Brad Dourif's
daughter. Fiona Dourif, yeah. Who's Brad Dourif's daughter. And Taylor Dearden is Bryan Cranston's daughter.
And who's that? Which character?
Taylor, she is Melissa King. The doctor that has the sister who has
autism. Okay.
Autism, yeah. Yes.
She's a good actress. So she takes that.
She's very good. Yeah. She was very good on screen.
Okay. I don't know how that connected to the studio, but just because Bryan Cranston.
Yeah. Okay. That's what reminded me of it.
All right.
Speaking of autism, so
fun. Wow.
That happened.
That's John at thehollywoodoutsider.com. What an idiot. All right. So we're going to leave on that note because the letters are going to come in now. So thanks everybody for listening. Appreciate it. We made it through the whole episode. Didn't insult those in the Spectrum community, but then that's it for the episode. Remember, the next time you head to a theater or stream comfortably on your couch, buy popcorn. Do we have an HR department?
I got to go catch a train. I'll talk to y'all later.
Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning... Fucking duck.
You okay, buddy?
No, I just had an aneurysm. I need a doc stat.
Charge 200. Clear.